Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Today's broadcast of The Exchange with special guest NPR's national security correspondent Mary Louise Kelly is part of the Justice and Journalism series and is supported by the New England Employees Benefits Company.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Spy agencies, terrorism, dueling nuclear powers. NPR national security correspondent Mary Louise Kelly covers a beat that's the stuff of high intrigue. And this past year saw no shortage of it. Russian hacking into the Democratic National Committee, high-level resignations and recusals, congressional investigations, and the overhanging question of how much the Kremlin swayed the U.S. presidential election. Then the drama continued this week, the Capitol Hill testimony of FBI Director James Comey saying it made him, quote, mildly nauseous to think that his pre-election revelation about Hillary Clinton's emails had any influence on who won the Oval Office. This hour in The Exchange, Mary Louise Kelly is with us. She's in New Hampshire this week as part of the Justice and Journalism series, a collaboration between the Rudman Center at UNH Law and NHPR. So let's hear from you this hour. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. I'm Mary Louise. Welcome back and welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Well, we should really start off by talking about the testimony of FBI Director Comey in the Senate yesterday, the House today. This has been all over the news this week. And it's a story, Mary Louise, you've been covering for a long time. What are the central questions at hand that these congressional committees are trying to get at with Director Comey?
Well, what's so fascinating is that yesterday's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee was supposed to be a routine oversight hearing for the FBI. The FBI is part of the Justice Department. The Judiciary Committee has oversight over them. So this is a kind of previously scheduled check-in. But nothing is routine these days in Washington, and certainly nothing is routine for FBI Director Comey. And it was fascinating to watch the extent to which we are still all living through the 2016 presidential campaign. That was the majority of questions, and he was really fielding two threads of questions. One, Hillary Clinton's emails, the story that will not go away, and questions. This was the first opportunity for senators publicly to question Comey about his decision 10 days before the election last October to send a letter to Congress announcing, I have to reopen this. New emails have come to light that may be relevant. I told you we'd closed this investigation out. Now we're looking into it again. He sent this letter to Congress. He said yesterday, did I know it would leak? Of course I knew it would leak. So senators wanted to ask, why did you do that? Was it the only choice you could have made? Did you not think about that this might have had a huge impact on the election? As Hillary Clinton herself has said in her first public interview since conceding the election, she said, I think if the election had happened before Comey sent that letter, I would be your president now. So that remains a live issue. Somewhat separately, the other story that refuses to go away is the Russia story. And it was fascinating to watch because Comey is really wearing two hats. He was there as the star witness for Senate committees and House committees who are trying to investigate what happened with Russian interference in last year's election. He is also, of course, the head of the FBI, which is running its own counterintelligence investigation into Russia, much of which is classified. So you heard him yesterday repeatedly saying, I can't answer that. I can only answer that in closed session. I'm not going to go there. This is an open investigation and I don't comment on it. That has drawn some criticism with people saying, well, you seemed very happy to weigh in on Hillary Clinton and what happened last year. Maybe you could be a little bit more forthcoming on Russia. But these are two issues that he opened up and was pretty personal about saying this has taken a toll. You mentioned he had a line saying it makes me mildly nauseous to think that I might have in some way tipped the election. But he said if I had to go back and do it again, I would make the same decisions.
Well, and you said last night at our event at UNH Law that it's been a wild ride for you this past year with all these revelations and surrounding the intelligence community. What's the number one thing, Mary Louise, that jumps out from yesterday's testimony? I mean, you mentioned a couple of things, but just as someone who's been covering this, what makes you kind of go, wow?
I think, you know, the takeaway in a way is, as you said, it has been a wild ride this last year. We have seen so many twists and turns that even those of us who are paid to track these stories and try to keep up are having trouble keeping up with all of the twists and turns, the steady drip of revelations every day. And I think what was striking to me is, yes, there was huge attention paid to Director Comey up there testifying for 4 hours. But as you mentioned, he is back on the Hill today. This is a closed session before the House Intelligence Committee. There is another Russia hearing. Comey won't be there, but former officials will be there next Monday. There are more coming on the calendar. This is something where, in a way, we are, despite having all talked about Russia and what happened with the election for months now, we're still at the beginning of some of these investigations. This is going to play out for a while. This week, it occurred to me, we're in the kind of settle in, pop some popcorn.
Oh, dear.
We're in this for the long haul. Again, on the Senate side, the committee that has the lead in investigating what happened with Russia is the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the senior Democrat on that committee, Mark Warner, this week said, we were hoping to wrap up our investigation into all of this by August, by the August recess when Congress breaks and goes home for a few weeks over the summer. And he said, that's just not looking possible. And in part, that is because they keep getting access to more and more documents that they then have to go through and process and analyze. Every time somebody like me or other reporters working this story drop some new revelation, that adds to the list of things they have to investigate. So the list of witnesses, you know, for everyone they interview, they're adding two more to the list. So this is something that, in terms of when we as Americans will get a public accounting of what happened and why this matters and how we should all think about this in terms of our democracy as in this country, we're still months and months away.
And will we get a good accounting given that Republicans on the committee have certain information that they're interested in that sort of supports their narrative? Democrats have certain information that they want to put to the top of the page, if I could put it that way. So even if we do get an accounting, which I'm now depressingly realizing that it could be a long time away, will it be an accounting worth reading?
I certainly hope so. And that work is being done by committees in Congress. That work is being done by the FBI. That work is being done by journalists who are continuing to dig through what's known and what we don't. Every day we add another brushstroke to this kind of painting that we're all trying to put together to get a full picture of what happened. But it is interesting. You mentioned Republicans and Democrats, and you saw that playing out again yesterday.
Exactly.
Where Democrats were pursuing a very different line of questioning with Director Comey. They wanted to know what happened with Hillary Clinton's emails and the decision-making that went into that. Republicans opened up their questions with Russia and what was happening there. So we have seen this every time we get a glimpse of what's happening when there's a public hearing. Democrats and Republicans pursuing somewhat different questions, even though they have agreed on a framework for where these investigations are going. And of course, the FBI, which is running the most serious counterintelligence investigation, really getting at what is known and what's not about potential links between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. It's not their job to ever give us a public accounting. That is something that is done behind closed doors with the purpose of perhaps one day bringing charges or not if they decide that there's not a prosecutable case there. So we may never get a full accounting from the FBI. We will get something, some form of report from these various congressional committees, but months away. The flip side, of course, is one of the central questions is if there was Russian interference in the election, we can all agree that was bad, and we would not want that to happen again. And there are you know, local elections happening in various places across the country this fall. Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, who I mentioned, you know, will point out there's a gubernatorial race on this fall in Virginia. There are midterms across the country next year. If one of the goals of this is to figure out how do we stop interference in the U.S. democratic process going forward, there's a certain urgency to putting something in motion now.
Well, and that does seem to be one area where there is bipartisan concern. For example, you heard Marco Rubio say not that long ago that, look, no matter what party you're in, this is a problem because it could bite the other party one day, but it could bite you the next.
Well, and Marco Rubio recently revealed that he thinks he has also been the subject of some Russian interference. So, yes,
other countries, Mary Louise, have expressed concerns that Russia's been meddling in their elections, other countries in Western Europe.
This is a concern in France, which is about to hold the final round of its presidential election. It is a concern in Britain, where they have a snap election that's been called for June, and where they have Brexit negotiations going forward. It's a question that is playing out in countries around the world, Europe, the U.S., other parts of the world, both in terms of there's a couple of things that U.S. intelligence say Russia did. One is actual hacking, trying to get inside computer databases, and then what they did with that information in terms of making it public through WikiLeaks and other platforms. The other one is this, the fake news question, and these armies of people churning out fake news that overwhelms social media sites. I was fascinated in the run-up to the first round of the French presidential election. A study came out showing that something like a quarter of all of the election and political related stories that were being shared on French social media were fake news in some way.
You know, a quarter. That's a lot.
And how do you separate that out? And how do you what influence does that have? And that's an almost impossible question to answer. You know, to what extent does that sway one voter? And to what extent, if enough voters are getting false information, might that have an impact? It's really hard because it's really hard for any of us to pinpoint exactly why you vote one way or the other. But it's fascinating, and it's fascinating to watch how that is becoming an increasing problem that we're all trying to monitor and figure out how you police it.
Well, and you mentioned last night that, you know, we're all worried about Russia and its power and influence, and yet internally, its economy is not doing well. The ruble isn't doing well. The U.S. has become a big fossil fuel producer. So, you know, we're having an influence on Russia's ability to gain economic power from its own fossil fuel resources. So, you know, one could ask, they've got so many internal problems. Why are they even bothering to bug everybody else?
Well, if you are trying to figure out how, as a former great superpower, you continue to project power globally when your economy has shrunk, when your military is now dwarfed by your former great rival, the United States.
Right. Your landmass has
You don't
shrunk
have the same number
days.
Of tanks. You don't have the same number of, you know, they still obviously have an active nuclear weapons program, and that's often, you know, it's something that gives them leverage on the international stage, of course. But if you're trying to figure out how you exert power and remain a player, then you find asymmetric ways to do it. And cyber espionage, cyber hacking, cyber crime is cheap. And you can have outsized leverage. And they are very skilled at doing that. They're not the only ones doing it. Iran is great on the cyber front, very strong. China. The U.S. is presumably up to all kinds of things, some of which U.S. intelligence would prefer us not to know exactly what they're up to. But there are certainly offensive and defensive capabilities being developed by every country with an intelligence service.
I have a really basic question, Mary Louise,
sure.
about the FBI and its investigation into this whole Russian drama. I thought the FBI investigated domestic mischief, crimes, and the CIA was more the foreign operative. So why is the FBI involved in something that involves a foreign entity?
Right. So the FBI, you're absolutely right. I mean, they're federal law enforcement. The old way of thinking about it would be the FBI are cops and the CIA is spies charged with more foreign intelligence gathering. And there are laws regulating what each of them can do, both internationally and domestically. But the FBI has huge international bureaus around the world. They're active in investigations, say, when there's a terror attack on a U.S. ship or a U.S. base or a U.S. embassy, that the FBI is in there leading those investigations. And the lines, I'll say a couple things. One, those lines have shifted somewhat in the wake of 9/11. The FBI now has a huge counterterrorism, not huge, but has a significant counterterrorism force and is involved not just in trying to establish the evidence for what happened in an incident, be able to prosecute it in a court of law, but actually invested in obviously trying to prevent something from happening down the road. That's a kind of shift in mentality. So the FBI and CIA are working together in different ways. In the case of what's happening with Russia, domestic laws are broken. If somebody's broken into and stolen information from the Democratic National Committee, that's a problem. If the National Security Advisor to President Trump, Michael Flynn, lied in interviews with federal agents about what his conversations were with Russian officials, that's a prosecutable crime. So the FBI gets involved in all kinds of ways looking at, they're going through very carefully the links between some of these officials whose names we keep hearing, Michael Flynn, Carter Page, Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager, and looking at their job is to look at where domestic law is broken.
I would definitely want to get some more clarification on all the spy agencies, the whole national security apparatus, how it works, what it is. But let me invite our listeners also to join us, Mary Louise. We're talking with NPR national security correspondent Mary Louise Kelly today in The Exchange. She's in New Hampshire this week for our Justice and Journalism series, a collaboration of NHPR and the Rudman Center at UNH Law. And we are talking about the year she has had covering the uproar in the intelligence community over Russian hacking, WikiLeaks, and the rise of what's called weaponized information. We'd love to hear from you this hour, so join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Mary Louise, you said just recently in a report on NPR, and I'm quoting here, the consensus of all 17 U.S. spy agencies is that Russia had interfered in the U.S. presidential election. A couple questions for me come out of that. First of all, how unusual is it for all those spy agencies to agree on anything?
So in this case, that consensus comes from the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, who is charged with coordinating and overseeing the work of all these spy agencies. And so what we had last October, a month before the election, was the Director of National Intelligence and the Department of Homeland Security put out a statement saying Russia tried to interfere in the U.S. election. And you have all of the different spy agencies feeding into that. In the case of something like Russian interference, there are some obvious ones that are taking the lead: the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, which is doing electronic surveillance. Some of the others, not necessarily playing a major role. Coast Guard intelligence, for example, would be the first people who you would call if you were dealing with a smuggling incident off the coast of Florida. They would be probably less involved, in fact, certainly less involved in an investigation into something like Russian cyber espionage. But they all are involved. They're all sharing information. And then the DNI comes up with this consensus. What has been fascinating about what the U.S. intelligence community and what they have put out on Russia is stating that they, with high confidence, believe that Russia interfered in the election. That is significant because that's a term of art in intelligence. If you say something with high confidence, it means they have more than one source. It means they have a direct source. They're not relying on secondhand information. They don't use that term lightly. In the January report, they talked about high confidence and medium confidence. The FBI and the CIA were highly confident. The CIA and the NSA, the National Security Agency, were highly confident. The FBI, medium confident. So
we'll pick up
there
on
are
that
some differences
thread in
there.
Just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I'm Peter Biello. On the latest episode of The Bookshelf from NHPR, author Benjamin Ludwig talks about his novel Ginny Moon, a young girl with autism who has trouble speaking up for herself.
Children in general have an uphill battle learning how to speak up for themselves, learning how to speak at all sometimes, and I really did want to give a voice to someone who otherwise would have remained largely voiceless.
Subscribe to The Bookshelf from NHPR on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Mary Louise Kelly is with us, NPR's national security correspondent, a beat that includes all the intelligence agencies from the CIA to the FBI to lesser-known spy offices you've probably never heard of. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Mary Louise, just before the break, we were talking about, you know, again, 17 spy agencies. Probably most listeners would say, I had no idea that there were that many. Which of these tend to be ones that, you know, people have heard of? The CIA, the FBI, obviously, the NSA. And which are the ones that people say, really? They have a spy agency?
Right.
What for?
Right.
So can't the CIA help them with that?
INR. Have you ever heard of INR? This would be the State Department's intelligence branch. All the branches of the military, so Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, they all have their own. Intelligence branch, and then they all feed into the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, which is providing intelligence to war fighters, working closely with CIA and others. Some of the big departments that you wouldn't think of as being intelligence agencies have intelligence shops inside. So the Treasury Department has, they are one of those 17 spy agencies because they have a office that is looking at, say, terror finance. Or sanctions, you know, things that tools that U.S. intelligence is using to disrupt or learn about nuclear activities or terror activities. Speaking of nuclear, the Energy Department has an intelligence shop, and they are looking specifically at what's known about nuclear weapons and tracking those type things. So there are Homeland Security. You know, once you start counting, you get to 17, and then the 17th, which is the newest one. It used to be we had 16 U.S. spy agencies. The Director of National Intelligence, which is one of the reforms put in place after 9/11 to try to bash heads together and say, you guys have to share what you know. Because one of the lessons we learned from the investigations into 9/11 was that there were dots out there that, had they been connected, might have prevented the terror attacks. The FBI knew things that weren't being shared with the CIA and vice versa. And so there have been these reforms to try to get these guys all to talk to each other a little bit more.
And I remember that was just maddening and frustrating and heartbreaking after 9/11 to learn, as you said, Mary Louise, that there were little dots here and little dots there among these different agencies that had not been connected. And you're right, there were these big reforms and we had the Department of Homeland Security created and so on and so forth. Has it worked? Are dots being connected that weren't connected before?
There absolutely are dots being connected that weren't being connected before. You can look specifically at, for example, how the database is tracking terrorists and flight lists and those type things are run. And it works better. There is progress being made. At the same time, it's very much a work in progress. There are perennial complaints that the Director of National Intelligence is this bloated bureaucratic layer that's been floated on top of everything but doesn't actually have people out in the field bringing in intelligence, that it's just micromanaging and needs to be trimmed down and made more lean and mean. And then there is the, you know, the perpetual tension in the intelligence world of it sounds great to say you should all be sharing information and playing together. The flip side is, if it is valuable information, that's information you would not want your adversary to learn, whether your adversary is a nuclear proliferator or a international crime ring or a terror group or a nation state, North Korea or Iran or other people that the U.S. is not exactly warm and cuddly with. And the more people who are read in and sharing information, the more likely that is to leak. Or to get out.
Right. So you don't want to make the loop too big.
Exactly. If you look at, for example, the investigation into Russia, the report that U.S. intelligence put out in January laying out some of the public evidence for what they believe they know in terms of what happened. That report came in three layers, three forms. There's the public form that you and I could go pull up online right now. There's a classified version that went to, say, members of Congress who had a certain level of clearance. And then there's the really top secret version that went to a very tight circle where they are laying out, this is how we know this. But it's very sensitive because if we want to be able to rely on that source going forward for future intelligence, we can't blow it now. Even the people writing that report, and I've talked to many of them who have top secret security clearance and were writing the top classified version, they aren't able to read the whole thing. They only have access to the section they're working on because you're trying to restrict and protect your sources and methods. Might it be valuable? Might somebody who worked on, you know, pages 1 through 10 really benefit and be able to connect the dots if they could read the last pages? Maybe. But you're widening that circle of who knows what. So this is something you're constantly, it's the eternal tension in terms of how you deal with highly sensitive information.
Well, and I'm wondering how someone could connect the dots to prevent another terror attack, given what you just said, Mary Louise, that, you know, I get to read pages 1 through 3 and you get to read pages 3 through 6. How
so
can we possibly
certain
communicate?
People, the head of the CIA has read the whole thing.
All right.
Certain people are reading it and trying to figure out who needs to. The president has access to the whole thing. His national security advisor has access to the whole thing. And you're hoping that those dots get connected, but it's always a balancing act.
Again, the phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Mary Louise Kelly is here. What questions do you have about all the hearings and investigations that have been going on and some of the uproar in the intelligence community over the past year over Russian hacking, WikiLeaks, weaponized information? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Albert who says, regarding state-sponsored cyber attacks, is either the federal government or Congress addressing the most difficult question, when should a state-sponsored cyber attack be treated as cyber war? Albert says, I ask because my research suggests strongly that federal criminal law is inadequate in dealing with such attacks in any effective way. Thanks so much for the email, Albert. And what do you think, Mary Louise?
It's a great question. And it is absolutely true that the rules of cyber war are still being written. You know, you talk to people who are dealing with this, say, at the Pentagon, and how you think about it in terms of offensive and defensive capabilities. There are rules of war established and in place for, I know, what a Navy vessel can do on the waters if it is under incoming fire. What counts as incoming fire online? And what is permissible in terms of retaliating and how you think about that with state-sponsored terrorism, where it is such a work in progress, where you have lawyers working on this right now trying to figure out. When we interviewed President Obama on NPR in December, he raised this and talked about, for him, it was something that was very much on his mind, one assumes, in the wake of recent events such as the Russia hacking. In terms of how you respond, what's acceptable, it was one of the strong criticisms that the Obama administration should have retaliated in kind. If the U.S. has the ability to hack into Russian systems and try to embarrass Putin, might that have sent a much stronger message than what was in fact done, which were some sanctions, kicking a number of diplomats, spies, Russian spies out of the U.S., shutting down a couple of intelligence compounds that we knew Russia was operating here, sanctions against individuals involved in the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB. But the U.S., as far as we know, now we don't know what we don't know. You never know what's happening behind the scenes that we haven't heard about, that hasn't leaked yet. But there were calls that the U.S. should send a strong message by retaliating in kind. And so far as we know, that has not happened. Should it? That's a question.
Well, if it's so clear that Russia was meddling in some way in the U.S. election, and as you said, all the intelligence agencies say, yes, it did. Can we safely assume, Mary Louise, that the U.S. is doing the same thing, that we're interfering in their political processes?
The U.S. has, in the National Security Agency,
They're not as pure as the driven snow either. I mean, if they're doing it, chances are we are.
Absolutely right. I mean, the NSA, the National Security Agency, is peerless in terms of the resources and capabilities that it commands. And it is certainly happening that the U.S. is engaging in all kinds of electronic activities online, some of which we will learn about, some of which we will not. The difference in what happened last year, I was mentioning to you, I was in Moscow last year when the news broke that the DNC had been hacked, and I didn't think it was a story. I told my editors, I don't even need to file on this. This is not a big deal. You know, let's all move on. You know, hindsight being 2020, I wish I had answered that somewhat differently. But the reason I said that is that it's not a surprise that Russia would be crawling around inside U.S. political databases and trying to get in there, and that the U.S. would be doing the same. What was different last year that we didn't know back in June of last year when we first heard about the hack is that that information would be made public through WikiLeaks, through other platforms, that it would be used not just to inform the Kremlin in their thinking, but used to try to actually alter the course of the U.S. election. And that is what U.S. intelligence has concluded. Russia was trying to tip this. U.S. intelligence believes Russia was trying to tip it to Trump. That is something we haven't seen before in the U.S., and that is what leads to so much of the fascination and questions being raised here.
Talk a little bit more, Mary Louise, about WikiLeaks. At our event last night, we got a very good basic question. It was from someone named Glee who asked, could you explain WikiLeaks' purpose, function, utility? I think most people listening, you know, sure, they've heard of WikiLeaks, but they don't really know, you know, what it is and why it does what it does.
So WikiLeaks claims to be a journalistic institution like any other. They say they are no different from the Washington Post or the New York Times, that they get information and it is their job to share it and make it public. That's Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, just wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post stating exactly that, that we should be treated as any other media organization. Julian Assange, who is in London, holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy, has not been able to leave for years because he worries that he would be arrested and prosecuted should he leave. What WikiLeaks does, though, is it takes vast amounts of information and without editing puts it online. That is something that mainstream news organizations do not do. So I would argue their mission is, in fact, quite different. They are active on Twitter. They, I believe, are tweeting this morning. If you go look at the WikiLeaks account, weighing in on Comey's testimony on the Hill. And in recent weeks have been releasing a little bit, you know, day by day of files that they've gotten. These are highly classified CIA files that are providing windows into how the CIA is conducting cyber espionage. That you know, the cyber side has historically been more the National Security Agency, but the CIA has, under its previous director, John Brennan, set up a big cyber shop. And WikiLeaks has gotten hold of a bunch of documents that the CIA would very much like them not to have and not to be making public, and they're releasing it drip by drip. The central question is, WikiLeaks does that with the mission of saying, if we've got it, it should be public and everyone should be able to weigh it. And if the CIA can't keep its secrets, that's their problem. The CIA would push back and say, we are a secret intelligence service. That's what we do. There are certain things that need to be kept secret. And mainstream news organizations, when you get hold of a classified document, go through a very careful process of trying to figure out, is it in the public interest for this to be made public? Is it in the public interest? Does it serve a purpose for people to know this information? Or is it something that I can report in a way that would protect sources and methods that we all agree might be important for national security? Nobody wants to put a CIA officer in the field at risk, for example, or their sources and agents at risk. So it's a process, an editorial process that we go through very carefully with editors when we get hold of classified or sensitive information. And WikiLeaks does it differently.
Well, at a time when public skepticism of that mainstream media editorial process is at an all-time high, a lot of people feel like, you know, that the mainstream media is I don't want to say in cahoots with the government, but hasn't shown a bright enough light on government that, you know, news organizations like the one that you and I both work for is too cautious, and that the public has a right to know what its government is doing, unfiltered.
Absolutely.
By, you know, mainstream
folk.
Absolutely,
the public has a right to know what its government is doing.
WikiLeaks thrives in an environment where people say, look, we want to know, we want to decide by ourselves, and we don't need the fussy old New York Times to tell us.
I guess the counter argument that if the CIA officer were sitting here would say, what's the point of having the CIA if we can't do anything and protect that information? And the way that you are going to find out what is actually happening in Russia or with Iran's nuclear program or with North Korea's nuclear program, they ain't going to tell you. You have to develop sources and methods, whether it's electronic surveillance, whether it's a human source who is high in the political decision-making process. And you have to then protect those sources so that you can continue learning from them. If they become public, you put lives at risk and you compromise your ability to learn what's going on in future.
Let's take some calls. Mary Louise and some emails. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. And Ray is in Londonderry. Hi, Ray. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Former intelligence officer, I recall the head of the Cuba Caribbean section at DIA was named Mary Louise. I trust it's not the same one. But
no ex-CIA background here.
Okay. I was calling, and it's probably a subjective opinion, but when FBI Director James Comey had his press conference to say he was not going to pursue prosecution of Secretary Clinton, I thought very strongly, and in fact wrote about it in a naval officer's magazine, that that was not his call to make. I understand that there were certainly strange circumstances, but, and yes, he's been a federal prosecutor. He was a deputy attorney general, but he was the investigator, the intelligence officer, so to speak. And then he decided that prosecution did not go forward. And I just thought that was not his decision to make. I wonder if Mary Louise would give her thoughts on that.
Ray, thanks so much for the call. Yeah.
Can I flip the question back on you and ask whose decision do you think that should be?
It would be with the Justice Department. I know the Attorney General had some conflicts then, maybe the Deputy
right.
Attorney General. But it's the, you know, I, as a Coast Guard officer, I sent a lot of stuff to smuggling cases you mentioned earlier to be prosecuted. And sometimes they were upgraded, sometimes they were downgraded, sometimes they were changed. But it wasn't my decision to prosecute or not prosecute. And I thought that was kind of the same thing with the director of the FBI and the Justice Department. I thought he overstepped his
right.
bounds.
Well, let's pick right. up on that, Ray. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, this is, you know, Director Comey has been obviously roundly criticized for that decision. He says, you know, you put yourself in my shoes and go back and tell me what else you would have done. There was no easy answer. And this has been, he said, an incredibly difficult decision for him. And it's same with his decision in terms of what he did in October when he announced that he was to Congress that he would reopen the investigation. And his advisors within the FBI and within the Justice Department apparently really opposed that. He said by the end they came around to it. But there was apparently a very healthy debate with the then Attorney General Loretta Lynch opposing it and saying, we've learned she thought, should I weigh in or not? It's going to look political if I weigh in and try to shut this down. This is the challenge with the FBI. They have a 10-year term precisely so that they will be insulated as director of FBI, insulated from politics. But as we've seen certainly play out this last year, everything he does in these cases has a very political tinge.
Ray, good to hear from you, especially given your experience. And a couple more emails after a short break. exchange@nhpr.org is the email address, or give us a call like Ray did, 1-800-892-6477. More with Mary Louise Kelly in a moment. Stay with us.
I want to know why it is that people suggest telling your congressional representatives how you feel about the issues. Does it make a difference?
Who can answer the burning questions about government operations?
How does the
the Electoral College work?
Is the system outdated in our current democracy system?
What is a filibuster, and what purpose does it serve in the government?
Who can help us cleave these Gordian knots?
Civics 101.
Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, NPR's national security correspondent Mary Louise Kelly is with us. She's in the Granite State this week for our Justice and Journalism series. That's a collaboration between NHPR and the Rudman Center at UNH Law. And we have been talking about the wild year Mary Louise has had covering the intelligence community, Russian hacking, FBI Director Comey getting involved, being dragged up to Capitol Hill this past week, WikiLeaks, weaponized information, and Russia getting involved in not just the U.S. elections, but the elections in other countries. Join us with your questions, comments, concerns at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. And Mary Louise, before we go back to our listeners, one more question about Director Comey. In his testimony yesterday, he said that, and I'm quoting here, Russia is the greatest threat of any nation on earth, given their intention and capability. Wow, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I thought that was striking as well.
Is that an overstatement?
Well, you know, he's got his perspective, and, you know, we are clearly Russia poses a challenge on any number of fronts, from the hacking question that we've been discussing here to it plays an outsized role in what happens in Syria. In what happens in Europe, you know, we're watching all kinds of interesting developments as Europe tries to figure out its future through national elections and with Brexit looming and with the refugee crisis still in play. So does Russia pose, you know, a serious adversary? Yes. And we've heard this from other officials who have described Russia as the greatest threat. It's been interesting in the last several weeks to watch how North Korea has suddenly shot to the top of that list as well. But I think that's a reflection of it appears that Iran's nuclear ambitions are being constrained for now by the nuclear deal that's in place. And so as you look out there at how the U.S. should prioritize national security threats, Comey's right. Russia is at or near the top of that list.
Well, and with all the focus on Russia, you're going there, Mary Louise, for 2 weeks. You joked last night that going to Russia to try to shed some truth and some light on the hacking story was in and of itself amusing. Russia not known as a society yeah. where truth
a
and light comes
A model of
forward.
Transparency and so shedding light on things.
How are you going to go about that?
So I'm in the process of figuring out who I want to try to interview there. You know, trying to cover the intelligence and national security beat is a challenge in Washington, and I am fluent in English and work these sources for years. So parachuting into Russia for a couple of weeks, you don't expect that you're going to crack what the KGB and its successor agencies have been up to. On the other hand, there is such value in having covered the Russia story, as we call it, for the past year from here in the States. I was in Russia last June, as I mentioned, going back this year just to try to see it from the other side. So trying to figure out who I can talk to, where I may be able to go, trying to figure out how to operate there is a challenge as a reporter. All journalists are aware that you may well be monitored by Russian intelligence from the second you get off a plane. Someone with my beat in particular, you know, my job is talking to people at the CIA and the National Security Agency, and so I will be traveling with a brand new clean phone and a brand new clean laptop and an alias email account because I don't want those contacts to fall into the wrong hands. And it's, you know, you practice the same rule that smart people do everywhere. Don't type anything you wouldn't want to end up either on the front page of the paper or in the hands of the Kremlin and Russian intelligence.
It's a little bit creepy, isn't it, to think that they'll be sort of watching you from the minute you get off the plane?
I was so disappointed last year. As far as I could tell, nobody followed me around. Nobody stole my laptop. I thought, come on, guys, try harder than that. And then I thought, well, maybe, you know, what I know.
Well, maybe they're so good. Exactly.
So you take care coming back as well. And I'm not going to use the laptop that I used in Russia to log on to the NPR network when I come back.
All right. Let's take some more calls from our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Amelia's in Manchester. Hi, Amelia. You're on the air. Thanks
Good
for calling
morning.
In. Morning.
Good morning.
So my question is, so
I've heard that we may just have to accept that Russia meddles in our elections now, and we have to be more aware of propaganda and fake news. I was wondering, is this the first time that we know that Russia has meddled in our election, or just the first time that the American public has been made aware of it?
Oh, really good question. Maybe it's happened before and most of us didn't realize that. I mean,
there is a long and rich history of interfering in other countries' elections, and the U.S. has been guilty of it at multiple times over the years and decades as well. So this is you're absolutely right. Not a new phenomenon. Every country is trying to promote its own strategic interests and thinking, well, that candidate might be more sympathetic to what we want to do, or might give us less hassle, or might just, I just like the guy, you know, who knows? But certainly all countries exercise what influence they can, both at home and abroad. The point I would make is as more and more information is online, the list of targets just continues to grow. And the U.S., you know, we talked a little bit about Russia exercising asymmetric power because it's pretty cheap to pay a factory of trolls to put out fake news or hackers to try to break into various databases. The U.S. is asymmetric in the sense that all of our banking is online in a way that a lot of countries are not. Our financial system is huge and it's online. Our energy systems, everything is networked in a way that just presents so many targets. And that is something that is worrying. And that, it, you know, as we go forward, both in the political system and just in terms of this great massive target, and the U.S. is the number one target of just about everybody. I mean, I interviewed the head of U.S. counterintelligence a couple of months ago. Counterintelligence, in a nutshell, being, you know, if intelligence is trying to steal your adversary's secrets, counterintelligence is trying to stop them from stealing yours. So his job is to protect U.S. information and databases, both government and private sector. And he talked about the number of Russian spies that they know that are in the United States, the number of spies from other countries, and said, you look at any intelligence service in the world, the U.S. is the number one target. That's what we're up against.
Thank you for the call, Amelia. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. And Mark is in Manchester. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. Go ahead, Mark.
I have a question about terminology and why we use Russian interference and Russian meddling in our election. I mean, if it was a Russian newspaper, would we call it investigative journalism? My confusion here is because it was a different entity, as far as I know, it wasn't untrue facts that happened with the DNC and Hillary Clinton's email. Those are true things. So I don't understand why it's called meddling and interference instead of like investigative journalism.
You know,
Hang up and I'll listen to you.
You know, Mark, he makes a good point. The information, at least with the DNC, that was real information. Now, Mark, Mary Louise did talk earlier about the proliferation of fake news that Russia was responsible for, stories that were about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton that were completely not true. So there's that. Maybe you could call that meddling. But in terms of what Russia helped get out in terms of the emails, Mark's right. That was true information.
True information, but private information. I mean, my emails are true. They're not fake news, but I don't want everyone reading them. I'm not publishing them online right now. The information contained inside the DNC database, absolutely right. That's not fake news, but it was private. And it was made public, and it was made public and timed in such a way that it appears calculated to have had an impact. And it did, you know, in the run-up to the Democratic National Convention this summer, we saw that the head of the DNC forced to step down. And then again, with the other, you know, major incident, John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's advisor, his emails being hacked into and then leaked, or, you know, spearfished and then leaked. Again, those were private emails. Much of it absolutely, you know, benign. We all learned his risotto recipe famously and other things. But it was the way that was carried out, timed and released in a way designed to have a specific effect.
Well, I appreciate the question, Mark. And here's another one from Michael. Michael says, as to differentiating between WikiLeaks and the, quote, real press and its editing of material before release and the deliberation of releasing classified information, what public interest was served by publishing and republishing the BuzzFeed Trump dossier? And you're going to have to explain to listeners who don't know what that is. But also, Michael asks, was the mass dumping of the Pentagon Papers heavily edited? Michael, thank you so much for the question. And go ahead, Mary Louise.
Yeah, and this is an excellent question because there are all kinds of ethical and journalistic and legal questions wrapped up in what information should be made public and what should not, and what serves the public interest, and does that trump national security interests, which are sometimes in direct conflict. The Trump-Russia dossier, which he references, is a dossier that started circulating in Washington last fall. It was put together by a political opposition group. It was commissioned by a political opposition group, I should say, that paid a ex-British intelligence officer, ex-MI6, Christopher Steele, who I am told from various people who have known him or crossed paths with him and by U.S. and British intelligence, is a credible, legit, former MI6 officer who has years of experience in Russia. He was commissioned to put together a dossier examining links between, examining dirt that Russia apparently had dug up on then-candidate Donald Trump. And some of it is pretty salacious. It's details to do with Donald Trump's sex life, things that happened allegedly in Moscow hotels when he visited. It also gets into details of links between the Trump campaign and people in Trump's orbit and what their contacts were with Russian intelligence and to what degree they cooperated or had knowledge with or didn't. In the run-up to the 2016 election. That dossier, which was circulated, no news organization reported on it because we couldn't stand up the claims. And so, you know, somebody hands you this juicy, hot document that is really interesting but would have a big impact on the election. And if I can't prove any of it or verify any of it, it's not a hard call not to put that out there. As it circulated, and BuzzFeed finally did. In January, they put the whole thing online. And then President Trump was asked about it in a news conference, and he weighed in, and suddenly it was out there. And everybody's talking about it. President Trump was briefed on, he learned about it, apparently, when U.S. intelligence chiefs came to brief him as the president-elect, and they had an intelligence briefing for him at Trump Tower in New York and said, sir, you need to know about this. It's circulating. So it suddenly was out there. BuzzFeed to date is the only news organization that has put it all online because it remains unverified. It hasn't been shut down. Most of those allegations haven't been disproven, nor have they been proven. So it remains one of these weird gray areas where we are talking about this thing. Anybody could go see it on the BuzzFeed website, but we are not at NPR making the decision to put it online, nor has the Wall Street Journal or New York Times or the Post or other mainstream news organizations. And so it's not a government document. It's not even a classified document. Nobody's leaking classified information, but it is a sensitive document about, you know, very salacious allegations involving the now president of the United States.
Well, Michael, I appreciate the email. And here's one from Elizabeth, relates to a question I had. So thank you, Elizabeth. She says, does Mary Louise Kelly have confidence that Rex Tillerson is taking advantage of the depth of knowledge within the State Department from career staff, or has, in fact, that staff been gutted? And I'm glad she sent the email because I did want to ask you about the relationship, sometimes the tension between longtime career intelligence folks and the political newcomers. You see this every 4 or 8 years.
Yeah, you do. And at the State Department, it tends to play out more publicly than it does in the intelligence agencies. Tillerson, like many of Trump's senior advisors, comes to his post with no government experience. There have been many concerns raised within the State Department through private cables and channels and then more publicly about the potential gutting of the State Department as they see it. There are cuts in the works. Tillerson has not given a lot of interviews, has not allowed reporters in great numbers, in the usual numbers, to travel with him as he goes overseas. He did come out and speak yesterday at the State Department and took questions, or did not take questions. He didn't do it from behind a podium. He, according to our diplomatic correspondent, Michelle Kellerman, walked the stage kind of like a CEO at a TED Talk, which is, of course, his background, and talked about his views for where he intends to take the State Department and how he will work at translating the campaign slogan, America First, into something resembling actual U.S. foreign policy. That's a work in progress. But to speak to your question about the career officers, that is worth noting because you have new leaders coming in, the very top echelon at the State Department, at the Pentagon, at the CIA. Those turn over usually with each new administration, not always. At the CIA, for example, we saw George Tenet stay over from the Clinton to the Bush administration. But that's unusual. And serving, you know, the thousands of people who fill out those ranks are career, and they are in there for years, for decades, serving a Democratic or Republican administration. On the intelligence side, just to nod briefly to, they are supposed to stay out of politics. Now, that line can be a very blurry one in practice, but they, you know, it's frustrating when you interview the people at the head of the CIA or the NSA and say, what should we do about North Korea? And they say, that's a policy question. I don't do policy. We just come up with the intelligence feed to the policymakers at the White House, and they make up their minds what they want to do.
We can tell them what North Korea is doing. We will not tell them what they should do about it.
We can tell them what the consequences of various actions might look like, but our job is to not make policy, and that is embedded in the system. So you have the Director of National Intelligence who shows up at cabinet meetings, advises the president, but by design, he's not the intelligence secretary because he's not supposed to be a political advisor.
Well, we could talk for another 3 hours, but I did want to get one last question in for you, Mary Louise. In addition to what must be a more than 24-hour day job, you're also a novelist.
I am.
Are your books like Tom Clancy novels, you know, given your work in national security where this, you know, journalist, we won't say who, is being traced by Russian officials, or is it completely separate from your day job?
You know, it is both completely separate and not at all separate. So I've written two novels. My first one is a spy novel where an intrepid reporter is chasing officials around the CIA and the White House.
Okay, that sounds
familiar.
This
is the Write What You Know school of novel writing. My second one doesn't have any spies. It's more of a psychological thriller. I am working on a third spy novel now, and my protagonist is this feisty female spy running around. I love trying to figure out how to tell a story in a different way.
Right.
You know, on radio, we have just a few minutes, an hour, like we've just had now, if you're lucky to get to tell a story. And so to try to figure out, how do I spin a story that's going to keep you engrossed for a few hours, hopefully keep you up all night turning the pages, that is fun. And it's a relief after a day of chasing officials who don't want to talk to me
right.
on the record to then go home and just get to make it up. These are all the great quotes I wish I could get today.
We have like 2 seconds left. Give us the titles.
My first one's called Anonymous Sources, and my second one is called The Bullet. And there's a good story there, which I'll share with you next time.
Mary Louise, thank you so much for being here.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.